Welcome back, new talkers, in podcast 620, the rhetorical presidency of Donald Trump. Suddenly, the United States could be involved in two wars, real shooting wars, one in western Syria and Iraq, and one on the Korean Peninsula. We're going to talk about it in podcast 620. Well, if you're in my neck of the woods in Minnesota, Minneapolis and St. Paul, it's snowing again. It was 80 degrees Saturday, and now it is snowing again. I don't think it will be around very much longer because this is a transition month, April and May, and the weather gets crazy. And so it may seem strange for me to suggest to you that get ready for AC checks, but as soon as it gets to be 70 degrees, you're going to want to have Ryan Plumbing and Heating of St. Paul check your AC. I'll fill you in on that going forward. But one of the things that I was talking with Greg Ryan about the other night, we were eating some pho, or pho, I call it pho, but it's great. It's the Vietnamese soup. We were sitting there, and I said, "What, you know?" He goes, "I don't know if you should be talking about the AC checks because it's a little too early for that, you know, especially when it's snowing now." But he said, "The thing that's really interesting that people don't know about it is if you have leaky faucets or pipes somewhere, or a leaky toilet or a leaky water heater, you know, a drip, drip, drip can turn out to be gallons, and this can cost you a lot of money in the water bill. And water bills are starting to get pretty expensive. So if you have an increasing water bill, you might want to have Ryan Plumbing and Heating come over and check out and find out if there's leaks somewhere you're unaware of. You got running toilets. These are basic maintenance issues, and they can cost you a lot of money. So here's what you do. Call Ryan Plumbing in St. Paul, 651-224-4771 in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488 Metro-wide from St. Paul. That means the suburbs, too, on both sides of the river. For four generations, quality replacement and repair of all plumbing, heating, and air conditioning systems, and leaky pipes and leaky toilets, too, residential and business. You business people with small businesses, retailers, you got a big water bill, you could have a leak back there and you're not even aware of it. Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul, 651-224-4771 in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488 online at ryanplumbing.com. Well, you know that the Trumper was talking with the Chinese president this weekend while the bombing was going on about this issue of trade and trade protection and manufacturing and so forth, because this is what the subtext in economics is all about. In the news these days, you got a lot of talk about foreign manufacturing with the new president. And in this mix, companies are deciding or preparing to bring some of their manufacturing back to the United States. I've said it, there are reasons to manufacture in the United States just as much as there's reasons to manufacture overseas. If your company is considering American manufacturing, please remember DepoStar, American design, engineering, and manufacturing right here in Minnesota. Visit their website at depostar.com. Well, I'm going to start by saying this is difficult for me. I sat down here a little while ago, and of course, you know, I'm nocturnal and I do most of my work in the middle of the night. I had a fantastic, steaming, hot cup of coffee, and I decided I was going to sit down and do this podcast and just talk it out. It's snowing outside. I decided I didn't want to do a walk and talk in this kind of weather. I have struggled with this topic for the last couple of days. Usually I post something on Sunday night. In podcast time, it is Monday night. So I kind of thought about it all weekend, and then I decided that I would talk it out, or I'd do a walk and talk, or I'd do an interview, or something like that. So none of my tools worked very well. So this is difficult for me, and I don't like doing this many political podcasts in a row, but I'm actually forced to because of events and breaking news and so forth. And as I mentioned, I struggled with how to do this podcast all weekend. I don't like talking out complex issues. I end up having to do my research, or at least looking at stuff and organizing my thoughts. And it's a painful process because I would prefer to just sit down in front of the microphone and do it and wax poetic, put it down and throw it up there. But over time and with experience, I've realized this doesn't advance the story. It doesn't even scratch the surface of what I'm trying to talk about or what I'm actually thinking about down deep in there on a particular issue. And I know that this is one of those things I have to talk about because I haven't been able to think about anything else for the last, you know, since Friday. basically, when the president ordered the attacks on Syria. Because I'm concerned, I'm frustrated, and there's a little bit of exhilaration in there, believe it or not, and I'm going to explain that in a second. It isn't the rumors of war or the strikes that is exhilarating to me, but the idea that this president's actions might actually split, break apart, tear asunder, and destroy the Republican Party, which, of course, I predicted not too long ago. And the exhilaration is that I predicted it, and this doesn't necessarily make me happy. It's actually more depressing than if I were to be wrong. I don't like to be wrong. I like to be right. So when I throw my money down on a prediction, then something like this makes me wonder, well, maybe I'm right. Now, I'm not trying to prove that I am right in this podcast, but this is a serious thing, what is going on right now in this country, not because we ordered the airstrike, because a lot of people in the foreign intelligence or the foreign affairs, you know, world and the intelligence world and the defense world would say that if a power uses chemical weapons, then something they need to pay in some way, shape, or form for that. So, you know, ordering the attack actually doesn't bother me as much as it bothers some people. What bothers me is that on a dime, because of a news story, this president completely changed. He did a 180 on U.S. foreign policy, and I think that's significant. Going back to 2013, when the Syrian situation blew up the first time because of the use of chemical weapons by the regime, Trump tweeted, quote, President Obama, do not attack Syria. There is no upside and tremendous downside. Save your powder for another and more important day. He also tweeted then back in 2013, we should stay the hell out of Syria. The rebels are just as bad as the current regime. What will we get for our lives and billions of dollars? Zero. Now, as President, then President Obama struggled to either pay off or defend or walk back his red line comments at the time, Trump tweeted, quote, the only reason President Obama wants to attack Syria is to save face over his very dumb red line statement, do not attack Syria, fix USA. Last year in one of the debates, as late as October, somewhere around then, Trump said, I don't like Assad at all, but Assad is killing ISIS, Russia is killing ISIS, and Iran is killing ISIS. At the end of March, Nikki Haley, UN ambassador, said the U.S. did not consider it a priority that Syrian President Bashar Assad be removed from power, overtly signaling a shift in U.S. policy from the Obama administration. Now, this change in direction started one of the now famous Republican splits, where you had Senators McCain and Graham going ballistic over this thing. There was even a fight over U.S. backing of Syrian rebels between McCain and Rand Paul about a month ago at the end of March, roughly 2-3 weeks ago. It seems like months ago, but it was, you know, right at the end of March, and Rand Paul famously attacked McCain, and there was a huge thing about that. And then around April 5th, it appears that the Syrians attacked a rebel group in a town in northwestern Syria with chemical weapons, sarin gas and chlorine gas. And of course, we've all seen the pictures and the coverage on television. It's history now. President Trump's administration suddenly began singing a different tune. And then on Friday, April 17th, as Trump started his weekend sitting down with the Chinese president, we launched a cruise missile strike against the airfield where the jets that launched the chemical attack supposedly took off from. The attacks were in northwestern Syria. The airfield is not quite near there, but, you know, southeast there a little bit. Suddenly, Nikki Haley started talking about regime change in Syria the next day, and the story was the president was emotionally affected by pictures of the Syrian children killed and injured in the attack. I think it was obvious from his statement. And then he launched the missiles. Over the weekend, Republicans split in two different ways on this issue in Congress and on social media. This is one of the reasons I was thinking about this all weekend. And to add insult to injury, on the heels of the missile strikes in Syria, which did not destroy the runway, by the way, Syrian military aviation is still launching sorties from that airfield and attacking people, certainly not so far to our knowledge using chemical weapons, but there you have it. The other thing that happened is the United States announced over the weekend that the USS Carl Vinson strike group will be rerouted to the Western Pacific off the Korean Peninsula, ostensibly to provide missile defense in case North Korea launches a missile. But there is a lot of talk in Washington suddenly about regime change as a solution in North Korea and regime change as a solution in Syria. What does all this mean? And on top of this, the Chinese, despite the friendly words and chats at Mar-a-Lago, were reportedly shocked that the U.S. had launched the missile strike in Syria, despite reports of cooperation and even perhaps coordination between Trump and the Chinese president. There are reports now, and not very credible reports, but reports nonetheless from a South Korean newspaper that they have moved 150,000 Chinese troops to the Chinese border with North Korea, the Yalu River, which, if you'll remember your history, was the site of one of MacArthur's disobedient actions in the Korean War and caused the Koreans to strike back across the Yalu after MacArthur was warned not to do that. And the rest is history with the Korean War. So that's why we're at the 38th parallel, one of the reasons. Finally, there are even less credible reports that the National Security Advisor McMaster's, controlled from behind the scenes by disgraced former CIA Director David Petraeus, has recommended that President Trump send 150,000 troops to Syria. The other reason there is some degree of vindication on my part is I asked consistently throughout 2016, throughout the campaign, and from the very first, that people devote some time to what kind of foreign policy they thought the United States should have. And I can tell you from the people that I talked to, and I can tell you from the coverage of the campaign, and I can tell you from the people I talked to in Iowa and South Carolina, nobody did that. It was too complicated because you'd have to look at maps and it would take people away from time spent bitching about illegal aliens and Muslims coming into the United States. You'd have to consider international relations on trade, defense, strategic initiatives, geopolitics, and so forth. Much easier to talk about getting the jobs back from China and building the wall and stopping immigration from war-torn Syria and on and on and on. And of course, predictably, Trump supporters this weekend went two different ways on this, as the rhetorical presidency appears to have split another part of his support and Republican support by extension, because he is not doing what he said he would do when he was on the campaign trail. On the campaign trail, he sounded like Ron Paul when he was saying we shouldn't have anything to do with the Syrian situation and on and on and on. And now he's acting like George W. Bush. So the moderates should be happy because Lindsey Graham and John McCain are happy, but the Ron Paul people or the people that supported Trump or whoever these people are suddenly are basically they've been betrayed. So the populist core of the Trump support suddenly has to make a choice about whether Trump is Bush or Trump is somehow some kind of clever, geopolitician or geostrategist, or whether he's Ron Paul, which he clearly isn't at this point. This is one of the reasons that I said we all needed to think about what kind of foreign policy the United States needs. And that means the voters, because it's the voters who have to keep pressure on these politicians to do things. Now the argument is, well, he has to ask for congressional approval to do these things. No, he doesn't. Look at the War Powers Act from the 1970s. He can act if he considers it a threat to national security anytime he wants. He simply has to go back to Congress and get reauthorization in 6 weeks. He does not have to ask Congress, the president, whether it's Trump or Obama or you, does not have to ask Congress for approval for a missile strike. That's nonsense. And yet that's the argument people are having on Facebook. Well, he has to ask. No, he doesn't. This is, again, one of the reasons I said people needed to study the foreign policy of the United States and stop listening to people tell them what the Constitution says and everything else. Do you want a foreign policy directed by former Bushies and people like Lindsey Graham and Marco Rubio and John McCain? Or do you want a foreign policy directed by someone like Rand Paul? Or for that matter, Democrats like Tom Donilon or Leon Panetta, Susan Rice or Hillary Clinton, among others. And why do they bring up Susan Rice? Because Susan Rice is a practitioner of the liberal interventionist school of foreign policy, something moderates have supported before, not because of the supposed proof positive, which came from a dubious source, that she is the one that unmasked the members of the Trump administration who were somehow making deals with the Russians. And in fact, the guy from Blackwater, who is Betsy DeVos's brother, I believe, was back channeling to the Russians before the president was inaugurated. So I don't know what is going on with that. Now, I mentioned these Democrats because these were the Democrats who were in charge of foreign policy prior to the election of Donald Trump. Maybe you're a Republican who looks at someone like Tom Donilon or Susan Rice and says, well, maybe there's some points there. Maybe I do believe in forward intervention. Maybe I don't think that we should just basically withdraw from the rest of the world. I don't know. I'm not saying one is better than the other versus a realist policy. So one foreign policy, the liberal school, looks at the people of countries and sects and politics within a nation and takes that into account, roughly speaking, whereas realism simply looks at state actors and responds accordingly. And that's often related to the Reagan-era hawks, and it's often related to U.S. basically protecting its own interests. But that doesn't preclude forward intervention or intervention in foreign countries of any kind. This is a long way from no foreign entanglement, so to speak, or the quote-unquote isolationist's idea prior to World War II. And why do I mention this word rhetorical? Why do I call Trump's presidency rhetorical? Well, here's what the word rhetorical actually means. First is used for, belonging to, or concerned with mere style or effect. Second is marked by or tending to use exaggerated language or bombast. So this would mean, for me, a rhetorical presidency is a presidency concerned with mere style or effect rather than substance. Shooting from the hip, acting emotionally, things like that. Just like many of his supporters, by the way, who reacted to politics from Facebook feeds, lurid headlines, attachments, and story shares people don't ever actually read, memes and tweets. And this is true, by the way, of the entire U.S. electorate, not just Republicans. A Twitter presidency. That's what this is. A rhetorical presidency, an emotionally reactive presidency. Unless we see some evidence that someone who has now twice not paid off on a political promise, who just changes because he, the moment demands it in his view, where is the solid ground that people stand on in that kind of an environment? It's one thing to be unpredictable. You know, Nixon was unpredictable because Kissinger could go to the Russians and say, you know, after 5 p.m., this guy drinks old fashions. He's drunk. He's crazy. He's upset. I don't know what he's going to do. But Nixon's foreign policy was actually pretty predictable. So being unpredictable in a predictable way is, you know, can be interpreted as being a sort of gambit in the foreign policy world. Being unpredictable is not necessarily a good idea for a U.S. presidency. And that is what this appears to be. I'm certainly willing to be wrong, but I think it's very dangerous. This is a presidency where something that happens on Monday, and I'm talking about policy, can be reversed dramatically on Friday, literally. That's exactly what happened last week in relation to this airstrike by the Syrians. Congressmen of his own party don't know what he is going to do next, let alone the president of China or the president of Russia or I don't know who, you know, you name them, Great Britain or who else. And clearly, the voters don't know what he is going to do next. And they're standing by in front of Facebook waiting to be activated by a meme or what somebody said or some ridiculous story that's not sourced or not true. This is not populism. This is the fault of people who supported this man for president as they are asked to defend him. And the question is, how do you? Because if you defend him tomorrow, then next week you may actually be defending another position because he may change his position. Now imagine you're a congressman and you're asked to vote on something like tax reform, or you're asked to vote on something like infrastructure, or you're asked to vote on something like repealing Obamacare, and he changes his position in the middle of the negotiation, right? Well, then people respond with, well, the Syrians didn't do it. It was the rebels, which is Russian propaganda. Which rebels did it? Was it ISIS? Were these rebels ISIS? Do you know? Because I don't. There are several different rebel groups, some funded by the CIA, some funded by the Russians and Iran, some funded by the U.S. Defense Department. Some of the groups that are funded by U.S. different departments of the U.S. are actually fighting each other, according to some reports. So I don't know who we're talking about. Here's another one. We just need to get him out of there, meaning Assad. Okay, how are we going to do that? Well, we just need to do it. With what? And then what? Again, it's the same question as asked when you talk about regime change, whether it's Libya or you talk about Iraq. Well, what do you mean, let's get rid of him, then what? Because no one wants to consider that. What do you mean, then what? And then come the other geopolitical questions, which are, what will Russia do? What will Iran do? Iran is a major power in the region. Russia is a major power in the region. China is a major power in the region. And they are powers of opportunity. In other words, their foreign policy is to follow the opportunity in terms of their state interests. If we give them an opportunity to take advantage of that kind of situation, what happens? I'll let you answer that. This is what foreign policy actually means. It doesn't mean building a wall with Mexico, whether you want to do that or not, whether doing that is the right thing or not. Foreign policy is about geopolitics. It's about the motivations of states. It's about, you know, things going on in individual states and countries. It's having a plan and vetted approach so that when you use force, it means something. It's making sure that you're fully staffed at the Defense Department and State Department with, congressionally confirmed positions, which the president is not, so that there are people there that can tell you what is going on in Addis Ababa. Because now with Trump, the guy that was telling everybody what was going on in Addis Ababa or Pyongyang, you know, who knows if there's anybody at that desk. It doesn't mean warning the target, although, you know, in this case, Trump did warn the target, which is the Syrian air base. It means campaigning on it, selling it, down to the actions that you take as president and paying off on those promises. Is he doing that? So put down the medium.com for a second and think, do you want another war? Or two, do you want to see the U.S. involved in an armed conflict in Western Syria and North Korea? And by the way, before you answer, remember that the United States is $20 trillion in debt. China is on the brink, by the way, of an economic collapse as well. So they might not take it so well if there is a potential threat to their border, either in terms of pushing refugees into China. Chinese do not like North Koreans. They have the same reaction to North Koreans as the United States has to Latin America, at least some people in the United States. So they might not take it well if that kind of a thing was provoked by the United States. It's something to think about. And what might the outcome, this is something else to think about, what might the outcome in terms of positives for the United States in Syria at the very least be? Aside from people coming home dead and trillions more being borrowed and spent, or people, you know, U.S. personnel being taken hostage for years and tortured and everything else. So before you think we just need to go over there and take care of this and get rid of these people, you might want to think about what the cost actually is. Now, if you are against this and voted for Trump, how are you going to defend this 180 on U.S. foreign policy? The man saw something on TV and somehow did a 180 on foreign policy, something he campaigned on. From Assad can stay and we don't care to Assad has to go and we're going to invade the country, supposedly, or we're going to use cruise missiles against the country, supposedly, or actually. Is this okay with you, Republicans? I know, and by the way, some Democrats are split on the issue as well. So now you have the guy who's getting support from some Democrats that the Republicans voted for because they hated Democrats. They didn't want Hillary Clinton as president. This sounds like something Hillary Clinton would have said, I'm going to draw a red line and I'm going to make sure that the military supports what I have to say. So you didn't want Hillary Clinton to be president, and you got a guy now who's about to get you involved in two wars. Is that what you wanted? Meanwhile, I got to mention the congressional races because, you know, people say, well, you know, the Republicans are in the majority and blah, 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 and you should be criticizing the Democrats and everything else. A Democrat candidate for the seat that used to be occupied by Newt Gingrich, I think it is the Georgia 6th, has raised $8 million in a congressional race, and the Republicans are completely confused about how to defend this president and the current Republican approach to things. And it is a bad indicator of the possibilities that Democrats could sweep the congressional elections in 2018. How does a congressman come back to his district on recess and sell this? How does a Jason Lewis, who's a non-interventionist, come back and sell support for Donald Trump in the second district? How does Tom Emmer, who nominated, is one of the guys who actually stood up and nominated Trump and supported Trump and endorsed Trump early on, how does he come back to the sixth district and defend airstrikes against Syria after the guy basically campaigned and said he wasn't interested in doing that? You see the kind of problems this creates? And the potential for those two congressmen in particular, or someone in, like, for example, Eric Paulson, to lose their seat because support for Donald Trump either dissipates or a great deal of Democrats come out to vote in 2018. And I would also, by extension, mention tax reform and infrastructure at $8 trillion. How do you, negotiate, and how do you reconcile those two things? We're going to have tax reform. It's going to be great. We're going to have infrastructure at $1 trillion. It's going to be great. Not to mention all of the infighting. Not to mention, but I did, filling key positions at the White House. And in various departments, and demands from supposedly conservative television hosts that it's time to pull up your big boy pants and defend President Trump, as though he can't defend himself. And reports that he is frantic now to make his first 100 days epic, even though there are also reports of a complete shift in power at the White House between Steve Bannon and Jared Kushner and who's going to be chief of staff and Rance Priebus and everything else. And 2.5 weeks will go by and we will have hit the 100-day mark. And yet Obamacare has not been repealed. They're not even close to figuring out a budget that includes tax reform and accounts for the $1 trillion that he wants to spend on infrastructure, which, by the way, Republicans pilloried former President Obama for doing, and the Democrats, because it doesn't work. Is there a picture to get here? Now, I mean, the question that I would have is, are they somehow smarter than they look? Is this some kind of vast chess game being played out by the master Donald Trump in secret? And the outcome will be regime change in two problematic places in the world and harmony between great powers, China and Russia, and so forth. Because you'd better hope it is. You'd better hope it's unicorns and rainbows for Republicans, because the alternative is not too impressive. Russia and Iran have pledged to hit back against future attacks from the United States. China has supposedly moved 150,000 troops to the border with North Korea. We're talking about fighting ISIS and ousting Assad with what, supposedly, according to dubious reports, 150,000 U.S. troops in Syria, which, even if we win, what do we get? At the same time, we're in North Korea again. And by the way, what happens if Russia decides to suddenly send troops to an airport in Venezuela? What happens if Russians decide to send, troops to an airport in Cuba for some, reason? Suddenly then, not only are we dealing with Syria and with North Korea, then we have an issue in Latin America as well. So has President Trump thought this through? I don't know, and you don't know, and we don't know, and that's the problem, because nobody knows if he thinks anything through. Certainly his performance to date indicates that he does not. And then all these other questions. What kind of foreign policy do we want? Can inaction sometimes be better than action? I mean, does this make Obama look smart by comparison? If inaction is ill-advised, that's one thing. But if action is advised, or ill-advised rather, what ends up happening with that? And how do you, again, move from being a Trump supporter, which is now suddenly being interventionist, to being someone who supports Rand Paul? And then finally, I thought, when I put this whole thing together and did all the research, I thought to myself, boy, I've got to say something. I've got to offer some kind of conclusion that advances this story. And I'm disgusted, frankly, by the discourse that I observed on social media this weekend. people who don't know where Syria is, people who spell it S-I-R-I-A, people who can't spell aircraft carrier, people who can't spell different people's names or places, concepts that are not even considered, you know, something that a sixth grader would present, bad information based on people who make crap up and put it in a news story and make it look good and then post it on a blog with nice print. And so somehow that means it's credible. People sharing stuff and then they don't read it. And this ridiculous infighting between people who claim to be conservatives arguing that because it's a Republican president, we should just do what he wants to do because, quote unquote, we're Republicans and we have to support our guy, and on and on and on. And I'm just going to offer this. Take it from someone who knows. And who, you know, before Iraq in 2003, you know, I'd been doing talk radio for roughly 2.5 to 3 years, and I read 8 newspapers a day, and I didn't understand the difference between commentary and fact. In other words, factual reporting or sourcing. It took me a long time to learn that. And I ignored, as many people did, the idea that somehow we might not get out of Iraq without considerable, you know, expense, all right? People like Trudy Rubin, and I've mentioned Trudy a couple of times, I pilloried because I didn't agree with her. People wrote things that said, hey, wait a minute, you know, this might not be such a good idea. No, you know, Saddam has nuclear weapons and we're going to go in there and this is what's going to happen. Nobody wanted to hear the alternate point of view. It was a minority point of view because it was all hippies and war protesters and everybody else that said this, that we, you know, should ignore those people because they don't know anything, right? Except they were right. They were right at the very least in suggesting that we were going to break it and then we were going to own it. Remember how people reacted to Colin Powell's statement and people were saying, how dare he criticize? It's un-American for Colin Powell to criticize this president, and on it goes. Now, from a military standpoint, the second Iraq intervention was brilliant. We destroyed the Iraqi army with basically regimental-sized units. Great progress had been made in U.S. war-making capabilities from the Persian Gulf War to the Iraq intervention. So from a military standpoint, oh yeah, it was great. But then came the occupation, and nobody had a plan for the occupation at the White House. And so we stumble-bumbled through God knows how many years until finally the solution was to send more troops and get this Sunni awakening group on our side and reach some kind of conclusion to stop the IEDs and to stop the fighting in Iraq. And we did so. And then the Shiite government of Iraq pushed the Sunni awakening people out. And so now those people are, in fact, ISIS. So these are the people that we supported, that we trained, that we worked with in order to reach some kind of conclusion. And now parts of those elements of those groups are now ISIS. These are the complexities that people simply do not want to understand. So when I say things like, is this what you really want? I mean it seriously from my perspective, having basically, I'm not going to say it was a mistake because I hate people to do that. I think I understand what Bush was trying to do in terms of, you know, breaking the mold and starting over and trying to stand up a democratic movement in Iraq. The problem is the area is much too complicated. It's much too tribal, and it would require the United States to occupy that country for the next 20 or 30 or 40, 50 years, a la Europe. And Europe was easy by comparison. And here he is launching airstrikes, putting his finger on the scales when it comes to Syria, pissing off the Russians and Iran. God knows whatever deals were made or not made with the Russians prior to the election, why the guy from Blackwater was opening a back channel to Russians. And now we're going to go to North Korea and we're going to stop this guy from doing these things that he's doing, and in one of the tinderboxes across the world. So there are many things to think about along the lines of foreign policy. And there are many things to read about along the lines of foreign policy. And it doesn't involve a wall being built in, you know, Arizona or Texas. And it doesn't involve bringing all those jobs that we shipped off to China to be put back in boxes and shipped back to the United States 35 years later. This is complex. It's dangerous. and this is a dangerous time. I hope he has thought it through. I hope that it turns out that he hooked this all up with the Russians and the Chinese beforehand, and we're going to come out of this into this incredible foreign policy victory for the United States. But, you know, I'll just leave it blank. But it's definitely something Republicans should be thinking about, because does not bode well. This shifting on a dime and changing policy and breaking political promises does not bode well for the Republican Party. And that's the result of a rhetorical presidency. So this whole podcast is just podcast 620. Some thoughts to consider that you may not have considered. Because, as you know, I believe that it is up to the voters to keep the pressure on these politicians to do things. You can't just vote and expect them to do what you want them to do. Once they get in there, they lose their tether. And that includes the president, it includes judges, it includes congressmen and senators. And what we need are movements of informed voters to force these guys to do what they say they're going to do. And they're going to continue to basically betray the voters again and again and again until people get better at understanding these issues and understanding how to put pressure on their congressmen. And by the way, in this way, we'll get better leaders, because people will come out of those movements and run for office, and they'll be informed and they'll understand what's going on. Or at least that's what I would hope. So that's what this whole thing is about. Don't forget the leaky pipes, the leaky toilets, and the other issues. Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul. They can save you a lot of money if this is your problem. 651-224-4771 in St. Paul. In Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. Metro-wide from St. Paul, it means the suburbs too, and online at ryanplumbing.com. I cannot forget my favorite client right now, 03D.com. This is the company that makes the amazing motorcycle parts and accessories, products and accessories, things that go on to your bike aftermarket. Lighting options are incredible, whether they are the rear lights with LEDs, the shock and awe lighting system that really shows how awesome your badass bike is, the front end lights that light the cowling so that you can see beneath the bike behind the cowling at night, and the bright lights that enable you to be safe, especially at night, and allow people to see motorcycles, especially yours. So remember, happy spring and ride safe when the snow finally clears. 03D.com, CIRO3D.com, or click on the banner at the top of the page at thebobdavispodcast.com. Takes you right to their page. Thanks for listening to Podcast 620, the Bob Davis Podcast. Thanks for your donations for Mobile Podcast Command, my 454 diesel ambulance, which is getting ready to roll out. I'm going to tell you more about that going forward. Thanks for subscribing right off the page at thebobdavispodcast.com, listening to the audio stream at thebobdavispodcast.com, subscribing on iTunes, Stitcher, TunedIn, blogtalkradio.com. And again, thanks for everything. Thanks for listening and all that. It's time to go, especially when I start repeating myself. Thanks for listening to Podcast 620. Shiny, shiny, shiny boots of leather, whiplash, girl child in the dark, comes in bells, your servant, don't forsake him. Dear mistress, and cure his heart.